Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, at the start of this caucus campaign season, we want to pull back our curtain here at Iowa Public Radio in terms of our political coverage to give you, our listeners, a little bit of an insight. Be as transparent as possible to how we cover candidates and issues. And joining us this hour, IPR's news director, Michael Leland.
Hi, Ben.
Hi there, Michael. How are you? Joining
Great.
Us from Des Moines.
Great.
Also in Des Moines, our executive director, Myrna Johnson. Hi, Myrna.
Hello.
And Catherine Perkins, program director of our talk shows and also executive director of our talk shows. Catherine, welcome to the program as well.
Thank you, Ben.
A little bit later in the hour, NPR's public editor, formerly known as the Ombudsman, Elizabeth Johnson, will be joining us to talk about the same sorts of things and answer your questions as it regards to NPR coverage. So this is really a chance for you to ask a question about how we produce news, specifically political coverage. You could also just get something off your chest about what you hear on IPR, probably not in the music sector because that's really not our purvey this hour. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Michael, I just looked it up. 349 days until February 3rd, which is the day of the Iowa caucuses, right?
That is going to fly by, Ben.
Give us in broad brushstrokes IPR's approach to covering the caucus campaign season.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you just pointed out, we're already in it, unlike some states that may start covering their primary candidates a month or two out. It's a year-long process for us, and we started a few weeks ago covering largely this time Democrats because that'll be a much larger field than the Republicans. But as the Democrats announce they are officially in the race and then come to Iowa, we have been getting out and covering them, and we'll continue to do that as new candidates come into the state. And then we'll sort of hit this period where candidates keep coming and keep returning, and that's where we have to make decisions because we can't just be all caucus coverage all the time for the next year. But we will be, making time to talk to voters. We will be talking to candidates. We will be trying to get as many of the candidates as possible into our studios to talk to them. Clay Masters, our chief political reporter, and Kate Payne in Iowa City are working on a podcast about the caucuses that we will roll out this summer and another option for coverage for people to listen to. So a lot going on between now and then, but right now our focus just is on sort of introducing the candidates to our audience, some of them well-known, others not so well-known, but we'll be there as they make their initial visits to the state.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to candidate interviews or coverage of candidates, Michael, who gets airtime? I know we have periodic questions. You field more of these types of questions than I do. Somebody down the street says they're running for president. Why do we or don't we interview that person?
It really depends on the race. I mean, for the Democratic caucuses, it's fairly simple because people who are declared candidates, we get out and cover them. When you're talking about some of the other races, we try to be as broad as possible in our coverage. Some candidates are better than others at letting us know that they're even in a race. We've had situations where someone, will call me and say, how come you weren't at my event? And I will have never heard of them and never gotten an email from them or a press release. As announcements are made and if they're official candidates in a race and they're on the ballot, we do news stories on them. Now, the extent of the coverage may vary. Let's look back at the fall elections last year. We covered candidates from the major political parties, which last time around were the Republicans, Democrats, and the Libertarians. And we covered, the congressional races, the gubernatorial races, the number of the statewide races. There were other candidates who were not a member of those three parties. They may have been running purely as an independent. And, you know, we might do some coverage of them, but probably not as much as the major party candidates. You know, at some points it comes down to resources. Do we have the time and the person power to get out and cover every single person who's running for office, especially people who may or may not have a very strong, you know, ongoing, you know, substantial campaign going. You know, we try to find ways to you know, at least acknowledge the fact that they're running and to get them on the air. But no, we don't give them the same level of coverage as others. And really it comes down to resources. We're limited in how much time we can spend, you know, just devoting staff time to it, but also airtime.
And also back to what Michael was saying about sometimes we don't even know that these candidates or their campaigns exist. That's sort of what the Iowa caucuses is all about. It's about organization, right? It's about establishing that grassroots network of support. So if we haven't heard of them, that also is a pretty good indication that maybe they haven't quite got that organizational level up to the speed that they need to for their campaign.
And a little bit of extra clarification, Michael. We had a major party status for Republicans, Libertarians, in addition to the Democrats.
Right.
Now, that the Libertarians being in there, that was not our decision, right? Major party status is something that's decided by something outside of Iowa Public Radio.
Right.
That's decided by the state. They get a certain percentage of the vote. In this case, it was in the 2016 election. They reached that threshold. Therefore, they were on the ballot. Now, to keep major party status, they had to get, and I don't have my numbers straight, but a certain percentage of the vote in the gubernatorial race they did not get at this time. So in the next round of elections, the Libertarians are no longer considered one of the major parties by the state of Iowa.
Join our conversation, Michael Leland, IPR News Director, Catherine Perkins, Program Director of Talk, Executive Producer of Talk Shows. Myrna Johnson, our Executive Director, going to be excited to talk with Myrna a little bit later. You'll want to stick around. She'll be talking about some expansion in the digital world for us here at IPR, also the introduction of our health reporter, Myrna Johnson. I'll be talking about that a little bit later, but right now we're focusing on politics. Catherine, as executive director of our talk shows, including this talk show, Politics Wednesday, tomorrow, of course, how do we select political analysts for Politics Day? We have quite a nice stable, over a dozen political analysts from many institutions across the state.
Right. And that's exactly what we want to have. We want to have a breadth of political analysts that we can choose from. A lot of times what we do is we look for expertise in a particular topic. So we've been able to expand that pool because we know that we're looking for somebody who has particular expertise on, say, the governorship, or we need somebody who can speak to political rhetoric, or we need somebody who can speak specifically to, you know, X, Y, or Z. So we have people that we know have expertise in certain areas, and we try to make sure that is broad enough to cover international news, Iowa news, national news, all of that kind of stuff. And then we're also looking for somebody who can explain that very well to our listeners, who can give context for their analysis, who can, who's just a dynamic speaker, right? Because we want to keep people listening through that whole 45-minute discussion. So it's a complex kind of, you know, complicated thing that we're looking for people to do for us. And when we try them out and they do well, we're going to go back to them again and again and continue to try to expand that pool as well.
When we talk politics, we have to talk about bias. We get letters asking us why this was a certain way and not another way. Michael, how do we define bias when we're talking about political coverage, and how do we do our best to guard against it?
You know, I think there are a number of ways to define it, but probably the way I think of it is, you know, are you trying to influence an outcome? Are you trying to put your own values or your own opinions into a story to a point where you want to get your listener or your reader to come to a specific conclusion? Other people may have a different version of bias, but that's, you know, sort of what I go to. And as we assign stories and as we write stories and as we edit stories, We try to make sure that we are including perspectives. If someone is making a charge against another candidate, we want to hear from that candidate who's being charged and give them an opportunity to answer. When we're doing, you know, more in-depth pieces, we want to make sure that we're considering a variety of viewpoints, and we want to hear from voters on various sides of the political spectrum to hear how they are seeing a particular candidate or issue. So it's more of an art than a science, to be honest. And but it's something that every one of us here at IPR strives for. We don't get up in the morning trying to figure out how we can make the people that we like in office look good or the others look bad. We try to get the best version of the truth that we can.
Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller in this sort of talk back to IPR session on River to River. Dan is with us in Des Moines. Welcome to the program, Dan. What's on your mind?
Thanks. You sort of addressed that with the last discussion regarding bias, but I was calling to ask about neutrality in asking questions in interviews or in talk shows because everybody's human, but I was wondering, since I'm not a journalist, what are the standards there? I mean, in court, there's a item they call leading the witness. Well, every once in a while, you'll listen to a talk show or listen to an interview, and the guest will say something, and it's pretty obvious from the way the interviewer asks the next question whether there's a disagreement or an agreement, whether the interviewer is challenging through their question or they're supporting them. They'll say something like, well, surely you don't believe, or they'll say something like, but don't you think? And you can tell from these subtle signals that the interviewer doesn't agree or does agree. And I'm just curious, what are the standards for that?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. It seems to be I am addressed in this situation here. I would be wary of interpreting too much into that, Dan, because there's a lot of different techniques that interviewers use here. Of course, we want to avoid loaded questions, but also very often we play the devil's advocate, okay? I will play the devil's advocate and take a side opposite of what the person is saying just to challenge them a little bit. And that may be interpreted as not agreeing with that person. But I get your point, Dan, completely. I've heard such conversations as well. Catherine, I'm sure you have as well.
Oh, absolutely. And, a lot of times before we're going to sit down, especially with a policymaker or a politician, there will be three of us in the room. It will be me, the producer for that hour, and Ben. And we will talk through the questions and we will make sure that we're being as unbiased as we can in the way that we phrase those questions and the way that we ask those questions. We think about the order of the questioning. And of course, we try to make sure that we have a good understanding of where we need to pin someone down. We really need them to answer this question. And we're going to give it at least a couple of follow-ups if they don't, because, that can be difficult. And a lot of times when you're interviewing someone for office, they don't want to be pinned down. And they're very adept at not getting pinned down. But you can't spend the entire interview focusing on one particular issue either. So it's a delicate balance.
And Dan, one other thing I'll throw in here is a broad goal of what I do. And Michael, please jump in here. And is that regardless of talk shows or reporting, we are evidence-based. A claim is made by a guest or someone our reporter interviews. The natural go-to is, what is your evidence for making that claim? And then if that evidence sounds, like it supports the claim, we go on. If it doesn't, there's a further questioning that happens. Dan, excellent question. I don't know if, Michael, you had anything to say to Dan on this point.
No, I think Catherine said it perfectly, as did you. Think ahead of time about what we want to know from a particular person, in this case, a candidate. What are the questions that we think listeners have? And we try to advocate for the listeners. And if we don't feel they're being answered, to a certain extent, we'll push back. And that may sound like we're challenging or being rough on your candidate if you happen to support that candidate. There will be people who don't think that we're tough enough on candidates. So I think it really, often depends on where you fall on the political spectrum and who you're listening to.
Right. And as a talk show host, you are a stand-in for listeners. You have thousands of listeners there. So very much in the forefront of my mind is what is what is in the forefront of listeners. If I can guess that or know that, I have to stand in and ask the questions that first and foremost that should be asked of any guest. Dan, thank you for the call from Des Moines.
Thank you.
1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I guess it's a pull back the curtain, be transparent edition of River to River. We're well into, a few weeks into, the official campaign season of the Iowa caucuses. That's the reason we're doing this, Catherine.
Absolutely. And just to go back to that last question and then talk about the people who were in the room again. When you have, you know, the producer, the host, the executive producer in this case, all in a room talking about those questions, you're going to have different viewpoints, right?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of gets to also something that we really want in our newsroom is a diversity of perspective, right? So we're always striving for having diverse perspectives represented in our newsroom so that those people are also involved in those conversations when we're crafting those questions.
Mm-hmm. So there's an expression that I'd like to have you, one of you, explain, false equivalency, because we will get questions via email or by phone. Particular examples would be global warming, for instance. False equivalency is something we're very aware of in journalism. Catherine, would you like to talk about that?
Sure. So false equivalency would be giving equal weight to two viewpoints that differ when the evidence very strongly supports one of those two viewpoints and not the other. So
mm-hmm.
Well, you brought up climate change, and I think the statistic that we often hear is that 90% of scientists, or actually I think it's even higher than 90% at this point, agree that climate change is happening. So if we brought somebody on, one of those scientists, for instance, to talk about research that, you know, is supports the idea that the climate is warming, it doesn't make sense to give equal time or equal weight to the perspective that it isn't, when the preponderance of evidence, scientific evidence, that is,
right,
supports the claim that it is happening. So false equivalence would be giving equal weight to those perspectives when the evidence doesn't support it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Before the break, I wanted to have you address this underwriting. We are underwritten. It's a big part of our budget. The largest, sound like a fund drive right now. It's the largest part of our budget, and we are very grateful for those who do contribute to Iowa Public Radio. Michael, how do we handle corporate or political interests in our fundraising or underwriting? There is a wall there. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I obviously not on the underwriting side, so, you know, as far as how contracts end, but we don't accept underwriting from political candidates. Someone who's running for office cannot say, you know, support for IPR programming is brought to you by Joe Smith, who's running in the second congression. I mean, we just don't do that. We do take, you know, we do have underwriters from a variety of different, you know, companies and people who may feel one way or another about a particular issue, but none of that plays into the news. I have no contact with underwriters. I have no discussions with our underwriting department about, you know, who they're bringing in and how that may affect the news. I mean, we're mission driven as far as our news goes, and where the money comes from and who's contributing to IPR, whether it be a member or an underwriter, just absolutely plays no role in our mm-hmm. decision-making editorially.
Right.
And people can go online, and I believe it's still there. I didn't check this before we went on the air, but there used to be a complete list of our underwriters on our website. So you can actually see who does underwriting with the station. And in cases where we may have even the appearance that maybe something could be in some way influenced, we're very eager to disclose that. So if we had somebody on the air, for instance, because of their own personal experience, but they also happened to be an underwriter, somebody who supported station, we would mention that as mm-hmm. we brought them on the air as well.
Michael, talk a little bit back to our political coverage surrogates, people with name recognition who come to the state, and they will in droves come to the state to support this or that candidate. What is our policy on coverage of high-profile surrogates who are not the candidates?
It's tough. I mean, personally, I'm not a big fan of it. I'd rather hear from the candidate. I'd rather to ask the candidate questions. But you know, when you know former President Clinton comes to Iowa to campaign for Hillary Clinton, it's hard to not cover the former president of the United States was in when he's in town. So then you have the discussion that if we're going to cover this surrogate from this campaign, we also need to be mindful that the other campaign will have surrogates in town too, and we need to get that perspective. But really, you know, I really try to avoid it as much as possible because, I believe the campaigns know this, that, you know, they're going to get coverage, they're going to get people turning out because they bring a big name to the state. And, we try as hard as we can to consider that in under the scope of our overall coverage and to make sure that we're not giving too much publicity to the fact that a big name is in town on behalf of this one candidate.
A couple minutes before we take our break, perhaps time for our executive director, Myrna Johnson, to tell us about some of the bright, shiny things in IPR's future that our listeners can expect.
Yes, this is a great conversation. I'm loving to hear from our listeners, too. I hope we'll hear from some more and sort of how they're viewing what we're doing and answering their questions. But I'm really excited that we are going to be hiring a health reporter at Iowa Public Radio. So we're continuing to expand our news team. We added a Western Iowa reporter earlier this year. And a health reporter is a part of our strategic plan in adding more beat reporters to our team, and it's going to give us an opportunity to really dig into a very important issue here in the state of Iowa. So I'm very excited about that. We're partnering. We have a nice funder from Mid-Iowa Health Foundation who is helping us make that happen, and we're very excited about that. And then one other thing that I think is really worth noting is that Iowa Public Radio is one of 17 stations involved in a new digital culture accelerator, which will help us think about how we use digital media in our storytelling. So many new ways to get information out to our listeners and to tell the stories that we have to tell. And being involved in this initiative will help us really figure out where to use what kind of digital media to tell our stories and to really think clearly about how we're going to be telling our stories in the future.
Let's go quickly to a call before we do go to a break. Diane in Davenport, welcome to our program. We don't have much time. Ask your question because I think you're dovetailing us right into our second half hour. What do you want to talk about?
Well, quick question. I wondered about fact-checking and if reporters... I'm not talking about opinions. I'm talking about facts.
Yes.
So if you have a candidate or someone you're interviewing and they say 80% of our drugs are coming in through people carrying them across in caravans and in a knapsack.
Yeah.
And the reporter has facts right in front of them saying, no, it's more like 20%.
Mm-hmm.
80% is coming through ports of entry. Would they stop them and correct them because... this is a fact, not
an
opinion.
Right.
Challenge.
Diane, perfect, in Davenport. Thank you for that question. We've run up to a break. We will address that in depth when we come back, Diane. Thank you for the question. Fact-checking and how it's changed in the last few years. Join our conversation as we talk about fact-checking and so many other things. Also, in our second half hour, after a short break, we'll be joined by NPR's public editor, formerly known as the Ombudsman, Elizabeth Jensen, will be with us. If you just joined us, IPR News Director Michael Leland, Catherine Perkins, Executive Director of Program Director of Talk, Myrna Johnson, our Executive Director. Boy, it's bad when you get your boss's name wrong. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
So good to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, sort of an insider's edition. Of course, IPR and NPR striving for accurate fact-based journalism is especially important in the campaign season. We have less than a year before the Iowa caucuses. So this hour, we're giving you explanations and answering your questions about our political coverage. Joining us to do that, IPR News Director Michael Leland, our IPR Program Director of News and Talk, Catherine Perkins. Also, our Executive Director, Myrna Johnson are all with us to ask your questions. 1-866-780-9100. Also this half hour, we have NPR's public editor joining us from Washington, Elizabeth Jensen, formerly known as the Ombudsman. Elizabeth Jensen, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be there.
It was so good to have you on about a half year ago, and based on the response we had from our listeners, they have other questions for you, and you are writing. People can find your opinions at NPR.org. You write about all kinds of things, and perhaps a bit of clarification before we set off here, Elizabeth, on your role, because it is really quite a unique role set apart from the editorial team at NPR.
Exactly. So I am completely independent. I report to the CEO. I have no newsroom authority. My role really exists as an independent internal internal external critic, if you will. So I consider the concerns of the listeners and the readers. So we changed the title to public editor, and I think that's important because it acknowledges the role of the public in what I do. So I take their concerns, I evaluate them, and take many of them to the newsroom and get some response from the newsroom. And if I think it's important or if I think the newsroom is falling short in some way, I'll write a column helping bring some transparency to how the newsroom is thinking and perhaps ways that they could do things better.
Okay, we have a little example of what one of our listeners, and we wanted to talk about anyway, fact-checking. Diane, in our last half hour, wanted to talk about fact-checking, and we have a little bit of example from Morning Edition to play here. But first of all, Diane, you wrote an opinion about this. You talked with people in the newsroom, as you just mentioned. Very labor-intensive fact-checking, but in our current news media environment, it's become a staple of NPR's political coverage. Why has fact-checking been ramped up, not only at NPR, but any credible news organization, you can say?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we're in an environment where there is a lot of spin, if you will. So everyone is mustering facts. Sometimes it's not always facts. Sometimes facts are misstated. Sometimes facts can be taken out of context. I think newsrooms in general are trying to take the audience back to the facts. So if you agree that the role of journalism is to present the information so that the audience can make up their own minds about topics in the news, then you want to give them, you want to make sure that those opinions are strong facts.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Let's listen to an example.
I think they want to go back.
Let's listen to an example from NPR recently. This is from the president's first primetime address from the Oval Office last month, in which he made a case for the multi-billion-dollar border wall with Mexico. He made a lot of claims in that speech from the Oval Office about drugs moving illegally through the border, along with, quote, aliens with criminal records. Here's NPR's Joel Rose talking with David Green on Morning Edition.
All right, so let's start with that last bit we heard from the president. 266,000 immigrants with criminal records over the past few years.
That number is basically right, but it does not tell you the whole story.
Okay.
Many of those immigrants were convicted of nonviolent offenses, things like traffic violations, immigration offenses, including illegal entry. And also keep in mind, those are immigrants who were targeted for arrest by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The folks who are showing up at the border are actually much less likely to have criminal records. And in general, immigrants are less likely than native-born people to commit crimes. I mean, the president likes to point out individual anecdotes with sympathetic victims, which is something he did again last night. But by focusing on these gruesome examples, his critics say he's exaggerating the overall threat of immigrants and is really playing to fears about immigration that are just not warranted by the facts.
Okay, so Elizabeth Jensen, there's an example from NPR there. And there can be, in fact-checking, such nuance from it needs context, as we heard there, to it's just not true.
Mm-hmm. I do get a fair number of complaints from folks who say, well, you know, when you do your online fact-checking or on air, it wasn't, you didn't say he was wrong.
Right.
And again,
facts can be used in different ways. So as Joel said there, the fact was correct, but the context was perhaps was off. And so fact-checking does include an important component of context these days.
Mm-hmm. And when thing is when something is just out and out not right, that is also said, right? Mm-hmm. Or have you noticed
right,
something
absolutely.
Else? Yeah.
No, absolutely. I think you have to correct something when it's out and out wrong. You know, we get complaints from listeners about newscasts. This is a really tricky issue for fact checkers. So the newscasts are sort of the reports at the top and the bottom of the hour, mostly that are short. If they include a quote from, you know, the president or anyone else that's inaccurate, they will sometimes say, the president falsely said.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, a fact check would include sort of the context, would include the source, right? It wouldn't just say falsely said. Some listeners hear that as bias. I think really what it is that the newscasters don't have enough time in those short newscasts to get in all of the sources for the information. But I understand why they hear it that way. And I think it's, I think it's a challenge for radio to figure out a way to sort of say, well, this information is wrong, and at least try to get into here's why.
The challenges of real-time fact-checking are quite different. There we heard a fact-check the morning after this Oval Office address by the president. Real-time fact-checking is incredibly difficult, right, Elizabeth?
Absolutely. NPR has put a lot of resources into doing this pretty much online. Obviously, you can't interrupt a presidential address or a debate or
yep.
anything else to sort of to insert the actual information while it's happening. That would be disrespectful. So it's done sort of after the fact, or NPR has a great tool that it's developed online, so it's almost a simultaneous transcription service, and then they muster up quite a few journalists who are in the newsroom inserting these fact checks in as close to real time as they can.
NPR public editor Elizabeth Jensen. Let's go over to Catherine Perkins, IPR program director of News and Talk. Catherine.
And, you know, doing it in real time takes a lot of resources, right? Because it's mm-hmm. more than just sitting at a computer and Googling to see whether something is right, because, you know, we don't do that either. That wouldn't be the right way to fact check something. You have to have at least two sources that are reporting the same thing. That's really difficult. So there are lots of times, especially local stations, run into that issue. It's like, well, you can just Google this. And I'm like, yeah, I can Google it. But, you know, if what I'm seeing is, you know, all over the map, then there's no real way to verify that, you know, what is fact. It takes some time. So.
Yeah, right. And Michael mm-hmm. Leland, you look supervise a stable of reporters at Iowa Public Radio. And fact checking is, I know, a big part of the policies that back and forth with reporters that are discussed, reporter-editor discussions.
Yeah, and like Elizabeth just pointed out, it's a very difficult thing to do in the context of a newscast where you have 45 or 50 seconds to tell a story. If we have somebody saying something that our reporter knows not to be true or contradicts what we've reported in the past, you know, we can usually work that into the story. You get a little bit more time to do that when you are in a, doing a longer story. But sometimes it comes down to the reporter covering them knowing that what they just heard is incorrect and being able to correct it on the spot. If not, then, you know, it may be something that becomes part of our later reporting on a topic. But it's important, but it's also difficult, both for, you know, having the expertise to do it, but also the time and the resources.
Let's go to an email that we have from Ron, Ron in Eldora. Ron writes, I'd like to know what policies you have put in place to keep an eye on stories that need follow-up when they could easily fall off the radar in the blizzard of news, writes Ron. Nice one, Ron, that keep coming in. He says, thanks for the great work. Well, Ron, thanks for that question. I don't know. Catherine, Michael, how do we keep things on the radar? Because that is a real challenge for us, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, keeping track of ideas on a show or on a team that produces two daily talk shows Monday through Friday is an extreme challenge. And if anyone has figured out how to do it perfectly, we would love to know, because we know that our system is imperfect. We have all sorts of boards, reminders, systems. You know, a lot of times, if you walk into our newsroom, you will see ideas listed on the boards in our newsroom. And so whenever we know something needs to be followed up, a lot of times we'll make a note. We need to go back to that. So it's an imperfect system, but we haven't developed a perfect one yet.
Elizabeth Jensen, as NPR's public editor, have been looking at some of the recent opinions, the articles that you've been writing. People can look up your work at npr.org. Special coverage is something that you looked into recently, and we've had plenty of it lately. There are degrees of breaking into special coverage that are offered to member stations, member networks like Iowa Public Radio. How does NPR decide when it offers special coverage? What have you learned there? What can you give us for insights?
I think in general, when it comes to the president, for the most part, the decision is going to be to air the live coverage. This is a policy that's gone back many, many administrations, and it has continued today. So, for example, when there's an announcement that the president is going to make a Rose Garden speech about a national emergency, it's pretty much certain that NPR is going to take that live. The question, of course, becomes sort of a news judgment. There was some criticism that my office heard because NPR itself cut away from that live coverage after about 20 minutes, mostly because the newsroom told me because the president had started to repeat himself, and he made his point a couple times, and they felt that it had veered off context, off message, if you will. Different stations made different decisions around that. So some stations actually went back to live coverage of the president. Other stations stuck with, Morning Edition, which the NPR itself went back to Morning Edition. I think there's a case to be made for either one. My personal opinion was that the newsroom was right to cut away at that point because the remarks were really sounding more like a campaign rally. NPR doesn't carry campaign rallies live for the most part. So, but those are news judgment calls, and news judgment by definition is a judgment. So not everyone's going to agree with them.
Right. Elizabeth Jensen is NPR's public editor, and we have a few minutes left with our insiders here telling you how we do our best to produce accurate, fact-based journalism, also in a controversial political environment. Hyperpartisan is a word that's often used. Charlie in Burlington is with us. Hi, Charlie.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's your question for our panel?
Well, I would consider myself a moderate politically, and I get most of my news, having said that, from either national public radio or public broadcasting. And I would like to make two points. One, the thing I like about public broadcasting is that they tend to give you the news without inflaming the information. Some of the other networks I listen to tend to be more concerned or more interested in making it entertainment as opposed to just news. And then the other point I'd like to make is I do think that public radio has a perception in the public of being biased to the left. And I would like to see more attempts to have both sides of a topic covered when they're debating something.
Okay, Charlie in Burlington, thank you very much. We go back to the question of bias. Michael, would you like to tackle it this time here? Charlie perceives a political bias, generally speaking, in our coverage.
Sure, and it, you know, it's not a new thought. It's not something that we've just been hearing, but it is something that we do try to avoid. When we are planning out overall coverage, we want to make sure that we're getting a variety of perspectives and not giving one group of candidates more attention than another's. But even when we do our reporting, we'll do a 4-minute long piece, and the discussion is always, what are the voices we need to hear in this? Are we getting the right perspectives? And then when it's written, does it sound too much like we're leaning in one direction or another? So, there are a number of checks along the way that we make on these. And we do try our best to avoid it. Some people do still have that perception that we lean left. We try very hard to avoid it, and that's what we'll continue doing.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Jensen, how does NPR deal with such a criticism?
Well, we do get those criticisms. I will note that most recently we've been getting almost equal criticisms that NPR is biased towards conservatives. So a lot of that is in your, it's in your hearing, if you will, and it's a term, it's a question of perception. So my office wanted to sort of bring some facts to this issue. So we went back and we looked at 6 months of political guests in 2018, from January through, I guess, June, and we counted every single political guest and their affiliation, and we came up with, much to our surprise, exactly even numbers. They were off by one.
Really? That must tell us that somebody in the editorial section is paying attention, also counting the numbers.
Right.
Well, it's funny. I asked the newsroom about that, and they don't count that way, right? So they respond to the news. They try to book the guests in equal measure, but they're not they don't have a tally on the chalkboard, if you will, of 1-to-1. And if you look at month by month, it would be off by, a handful of people, or I think the worst month it was off by 10. I can't remember in whose favor. But ultimately, over time, it balanced out. And I think that is what the newsroom strives to do. So I was quite pleasantly surprised.
Interesting interesting data there, Elizabeth Jensen. I also saw in reading your work online this quote: "My office heard from readers who complained that only the president's inaccuracies were flagged, not the accurate statements." Respond to that, because it we are in a new news environment, political environment, when you have people writing you expecting us to flag accurate statements.
Right, right. So that was in the context of fact-checking. I do think that there is an expectation that our political leaders will speak factually. They're clearly there to muster their case for their policy, et cetera. And I think that there's just an expectation that they are speaking and using correct facts. So I don't think that a news organization has an obligation to say this was right. That is the expectation, that it's accurate unless proven inaccurate. So some listeners and readers hear it differently, but I think that's gone back, that policy has gone back a long ways, and I don't see any reason to change it at this point.
We have a couple minutes left. I wanted to get in one point a caller brought up. We won't have time to bring that caller on, but diversity, minority voices in our coverage. Catherine Perkins, can I pitch that to you?
Absolutely. So that is something we strive for, that we know we don't always do as good a job at that as we really should. Some of that comes down to diversity in the newsroom, which I talked about a little bit before, which again, we strive for, but has been difficult to accomplish. But also, it also gets back to giving our reporters and our hosts permission to be deliberate about bringing those voices to our air. And so that's something that we continue to work on.
Okay. Myrna Johnson has been with us this entire hour as well, our executive director of Iowa Public Radio, sharing a little bit of our expansion here. Myrna, what was left out of what you wanted to get across to our listeners? And we have them for a minute or so more.
Well, I mean, I guess one thing I wanted to let Iowa City listeners know that we have a new frequency in Iowa City, 95.3 FM, bringing news in Studio One. Maybe a little better reception for some folks who are not getting 90.9 well in Iowa City, so that's exciting. And then just also a note that we have some infrastructure requests before the state legislature, and so we're going to be asking them to help us do some technology reinvestment on a couple of our biggest stations here in the state. So that may be something you'll be hearing about as well.
Mm-hmm. Michael, perhaps as we delve in further into the caucus campaign season, what can people expect online in terms of keeping track of the candidates that we'll have here crisscrossing the state?
We will be collecting all of our stories and putting them online. We'll be working with our new digital producer to discuss what our online efforts are going to look like over the coming months. That is a position that we've just hired someone for, and we'll begin working with that person in the next few weeks. But as we go on, our goal is to try to create something that you can come back to and check, whether it's to learn more about candidates or hear what candidates are saying on the road, in addition to what you're hearing on the radio, not always the exact same thing.
Catherine Perkins, a quick word is all we have time for.
And also there are some conversations taking place between stations across the country, actually, about how best to do that digital presentation and whether there's any opportunity for collaboration around that.
Okay, very good. We've run out of time. Thank you very much. Catherine Perkins, Myrna Johnson, Michael Leland, and NPR's public editor, Elizabeth Jensen. Thank you all for joining us this half hour.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Tomorrow on the program, of course, it's a Politics Wednesday. Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford of Drake University will be joining us tomorrow with their analysis. We'll also talk about Bernie Sanders back in the race, missing a win in the Iowa caucuses last time around in 2016 by a hair. We'll talk about his chances for 2020 when we talk tomorrow on Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope to talk with you then.